Welcome to the Access VFX
podcast,
pursuing inclusion,
diversity,
awareness
and opportunity
in VFX,
animation
and games industries.
Hi, I'm Simon Devereaux, founder and director of Access VFX, bringing the visual effects, animation and games industry together, working towards a shared goal to make our industry more diverse and inclusive by taking action rather than just talking about it.
Hello, I'm Simon, founder and director of Access VFX, and welcome to another episode of the Access VFX podcast, another special episode discussing all things artificial intelligence and machine learning. Joining AVFX hero Nene Parsotam for this conversation on the darker side of AI are creative communicator, artist, and social media producer at Unfold Stories, Savannah Serrana, Global Head of Creative Strategy at Automated Creative, Amy Wright, and co-founder and head of video production at UniVivid, Jide Johnson. This is another riveting episode full of incredible insight from an excellent panel of intelligent people. So please stop what you're doing and enjoy episode 2, season 3 of the Access VFX podcast, The Dark Side of AI.
Excellent. Well, Simon, thank you so much for the intro. Hello, everyone. Very excited to be back with the second part of our special on AI podcast with Access VFX and for Access VFX. If you haven't listened to part one of this AI special, no problem. There's no spoilers here, but it does mean I have to introduce myself. So I am an advertising creative director, and I'm one of the current and the original board members for Access VFX. Because I love all things animation and games and character design and whatnot. So I love it. So that is pretty much why I'm here. So part one of this podcast for this AI special, we focused on AI's, quite frankly, meteoric rise to prominence and its potential to change and disrupt the creative landscape. However, like a good Marvel movie, just because we know it has potential and we know that it can be good, it doesn't mean that we close our eyes to the potential dangers and challenges that this particular tech can have, especially in terms of jobs, especially in terms of everything from deep fakes to cheating to what have you. So today's conversation is going to take a little bit of a deep dive into some of these more controversial issues and take a look at it and see maybe how we can encourage people to navigate some of these challenges, because quite frankly, they are not going away. So as usual, we have a broad spectrum of creatives, because I like speaking to creatives from different disciplines. And again, with AI, it covers it affects all of us, no matter which part of the creative industry that you're in, it's going to challenge your field. So all here to learn from each other. So let's kick off. So I'm going to go around the table and I'm going to ask, let me see who I'm going to pick on. Jide, I'm going to start right with you. Please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so hi everyone, my name is Jide Johnson. I run Anibox Studios. Anibox is a small animation company based in Farringdon, central London. We traditionally, earlier on, specialized in short form adverts, mainly animated and a bit of live action adverts for big brands such as Google, Skype, PwC, Deloitte, all types of corporate institutions. And more recently, in the last 4 or 5 years, we've pivoted over to the more television and intellectual property space. So we've done a lot of work with brands like Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, Sony Animation Pictures, and we're developing a whole bunch of our own IP in-house. And we recently launched an internship called Anibox Access, and that's to help animators from all backgrounds gain more access into the animation industry, especially ones who are at an early stage in their career. That's me in a nutshell.
Fantastic. Savina, I'm going to go to you next. Do you want to introduce yourself for us?
Yes, of course. Excited to be here. So my name's Savina. I'm the co-creator of a creative studio called Identity 2.0. We work at the intersection of digital rights, identity and technology, essentially trying to take these like technical issues and breaking them down into like fun, interactive and basically accessible experiences. And I'm also a creative producer. So I work a lot with charities, NGOs, and social causes, essentially trying to bring their content and ideas to life.
Fantastic. Awesome. Awesome. And last, Amy, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hey guys, my name is Amy Wright and I work at Automated Creative. We are an ad tech platform dealing with creative effectiveness. And what we do in a nutshell is make and optimize ad creative using live data and insight. And we are doing that with a blend of our own proprietary tech, which uses AI, machine learning and automation. And so kind of using this technology every single day. My decades of kind of experience comes from advertising creative background. So I've moved into the tech side. Big gamer, storyteller. So this topic is a real intersection of all my kind of passions and interests. So looking forward to speaking with the guys a bit more on this.
Fantastic. Love it. Love it. Thank you, Amy. And thank you all of you actually for joining me. So I'm going to get straight into it. I'm going to try to kind of like pick a softer subject to think about it and to talk about it and then segue into the kind of more meatier, harder stuff. So I'm going to start off with the writer strikes. As you may or may not know, I think it's either Marvel or Disney. No, it was Marvel. Marvel has just voted to unionize, and it's Marvel's VFX VFX part of their industry that's decided to put together a union. Disney did one, I think it was about a month ago as well, and it's all based on the writer strikes. Now, some people can look at the writer strikes and think, well, it's writers, it's Hollywood, it's entertainment, it doesn't really affect us, but it does. The knock-on effect is actually quite severe when it comes to that part of the industry. Part of why they're having strikes is AI and the threat of AI. And I've looked into it, and it's not just so much about taking people's jobs, it's more about how AI will make things more difficult, and then again, with the IP and the legal side of it, which we'll talk about later. So the question for all of you, how much do you think AI or the threat of AI has contributed to this particular situation? And do you think it's justified? Don't let me pick someone. Okay, I'm going to go in reverse order then. Amy, I'm going to start with you because you spoke last.
So I think Hollywood and the writers have a massive right to be concerned. But a lot of that concern comes from the way that they're being treated by larger organisations. AI is not the first threat to the writers, and that's predominantly being caused by mistreatment by really large institutions that are not respecting them and their work. There's a lot of other threats that are involved in the writer strike. So things like streaming technology and contributing to a lack of residuals. So AI is definitely a component, but it's almost a symptom of that wider systemic threat. If they were being treated correctly by their employers, if they were being respected for their artistry and discipline, I think AI would be seen as a lot more of a positive force within the industry. But quite rightly, they're concerned about how they're being treated because of everything else.
Amy, do you want to have a look into what's happening with your internet? I'm getting a internet thingy here. Take a look at that, and we'll continue. Sabina, do you want to carry on while we wait for Amy to sort that out?
Yeah, sure. Mm. So with the writer strikes, from what I can see, it feels like a kind of accumulation and like a crux point of so many different things that are happening. So you've got the intense kind of focus on streaming platforms with their own model, which we've seen from like places like Spotify have done to musicians, places like Netflix are also doing to kind of writers as well. Like it's taking away credit from the actual creators and putting more money into like shareholders. So where the value and the actual money is being moved, even though, you know, we're seeing like huge numbers of people watching lots of things at once, I think the shift has been away from like more traditional models where writers have been kind of respected and paid for their time fairly. And so I think that's a huge component of why we're seeing the writer strikes. But also I do think AI has a role to play because it feels like what's happening with AI, there was a huge hype cycle and a lot of fear mongering as a result of that as well, in terms of AI is able to produce this. And for the creative industry, a lot of us, I even being involved in someone who understands what AI is capable of doing, got my back up a bit of like, is this going to take away my job? You know, what's the kind of world that this is going to lead to. And I guess my fear was more based around the hype and the way people were talking about it rather than the actual capabilities of it. And I do think a lot of the time when you're looking at like the kind of execs of these places where the people are striking from, I think that understanding of AI is built, is kind of fueled by this hype cycle.
Exactly.
And so they're seeing it as, wow, it can do all these things. When in reality, I personally don't think AI can ever really replace creativity. Yes. It's not going to be able to replace that spark that you have in a writer's room, that you have amongst people who have lived experiences of stuff. It's just going to be able to replicate things and package it up in a different way. But it feels like a lot of these execs are saying AI is going to be the future. And so I think writers, any artist really has the right to say, no, I don't think that this is going to be able to replace me. And I do think that's part of why you're seeing pushback. And it's one of the things that they're fighting for. They're fighting for protection.
Yes.
They're fighting for like the right to remain creative without some sort of like AI overview of like optimizing my writing, because creativity isn't there to be optimized, it's there to be enjoyed.
100%. Love that. 100%. And it's really interesting what you said about how people are afraid of their jobs being taken away. When I looked at into this, when it came to the VX side of it, they were more about, well, actually AI is going to actually triple our workload because they're going to get a shot done in AI and then they're going to still ask a VFX artist to fix it. So they're like, why are we doing the same job twice if AI is supposed to kind of like, you know, streamline the process and whatnot? So yeah, 100% agree. Jude, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I guess like, I think another way that AI impacts the strike situation makes me compare what's happening now to the strikes of 2007, right?
Oof, so like, remember that.
Yeah, I remember that. Like, you know, back that's when I was at university. And back then, you know, technology was obviously less advanced and there was a lot less content to view, less content creators. And, you know, these were the days when I was watching shows like Heroes and Prison Break and Lost. And and we really felt it because like season, like I think it was like season three of Heroes didn't arrive until, you know, ages. And by the time it did, no one really cared anymore.
And exactly, and
the industry really felt it, which I think resulted in the acceleration of, you know, unscripted content. And, you know, forgive me if that's a historically inaccurate statement, but I was just a student at the time. But anyway, you know, now AI gives us all of this unprecedented access to an unlimited library of content on all of these streaming platforms. So although there's a strike, it doesn't make the mass audience give much of a toss because, you know, we all know we can go on Netflix, Prime or Disney Plus and, you know, like watch whatever we want. So, you know, it's not like the strike has caused streaming services to shut down or anything. You know, right now, I think there's like 500 shows per year that come out and like as opposed to, let's say, maybe 10 years ago when the amount of shows being released per year was probably significantly less than half of that. So the strike today actually has less impact on people giving a toss because of AI and the amount of options that it gives us online. So yeah, like that's like what I think, that's what I think AI has in terms of an effect on people actually caring. Lots of people are talking about it, but you know, this evening they're still gonna go and do Netflix and chill. Do you know what I mean? Whereas when I was at uni, it was like, oh damn, like I can't watch the next season of Heroes now, and there's not much else to watch but maybe try and go on a pirate website, which might, you know, which might download a virus onto my computer. So everyone really felt it then, you know.
So interesting. It's interesting what you said, because it does sound like that point of view is from a consumer's point of view, right? So it's about people who will just be watching it and they don't really care what happens in the background. They just as long as they can still consume their content. But from an industry's perspective, from people actually inside the industry and working, it's actually a different ballgame, isn't it? Because you know, you saw what happened with the 2007 strikes. Yeah. I remember watching Smallville at the time. I'm showing my age here. And that season seven, I think it was an absolute mess. It was a mess. Yeah. So I think the same thing might happen here. So in terms, yes, they'll still be streaming, but the quality will drop significantly.
Yeah.
I think that's the fallout from this. Yeah. But interesting point. Because you're right. There's a difference between the consumer and then in industry and how they both see things.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right.
Amy, what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think consumers are more savvy now. So I think people recognize that there is an impact. I think the rise of technology generally has mean there's much more democratization of access to different types of tools. So people are creators themselves now in a way that they never have been before.
Okay.
So I think that empathy for a creator is definitely more in the public conscience. I think we've got people who are much more considered around strike action, for example. If I think about how the attitudes towards strikers has changed even in the last 10, 15 years, it's quite fundamental. So I do think we're seeing this different power shift moving with some more empathy towards individual creators, individual workers, and it's off the backdrop of kind of bigger economic pressures. So it's not only artists that are struggling, it's kind of the broader community as well. And I think a little bit more of that empathy is going to be coming forward.
Okay.
And ultimately, yeah, when there is so much choice to watch now, you can pick multiple streaming channels. People are understanding that the one differentiator is creative quality. It's not just a nice to have, it's a business imperative. So I think the more that studios are going to work on this, they have to recognize that the skill is in the artist and ultimately hand more power and control back to them.
Interesting. But do you think AI would do that, but just in a different way, just based on what you just said?
Yeah, so I think AI is this piece. Right, it's a neutral tool. AI itself is neutral. It depends who controls it, what it's trained on, and how it's deployed. And it's like a hammer, right? You can use it to fix something or you can use it as a weapon. So it's really important that we're thinking about not only can AI be a threat and an issue, but actually some of the solutions to this problem may also exist in AI and technology.
I think so. So Julie, continue with what you were saying, actually, because it was actually a really interesting point, because like I said, you've come at it from a consumer's point of view, but you are a producer though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I say, there's an abundance of content out there that, consumers have to watch now. From a producer's point of view, I think that at the end of the day, AI is something that I think there's, if I'm honest, I just think there's a bit too much fear mongering, and a bit like what Savina was saying, yeah. There's just tons of hype around what we should be scared about where we're spending a bit too much time worried. We're spending too much time in fear about, it taking our jobs and all of this stuff, as opposed to, sitting down, putting our heads together and trying to actually figure out how, not only how this can create more jobs, but how it can create more freedom and how we can like solve more, like as world problems. And, as it pertains to streaming, maybe we should be trying to figure out how AI can, help us solve some of these problems in general. But it's not something that I'm, AI is not something that I'm worried about. Mm. And I'll give you an example why. Because, let's just take, if you go back in history, right, at one point, there was, I'm sure people who were creating images if you go back to maybe like the Stone Age or something, there were people who probably used sharp objects to etch images into walls and stuff like that. And then eventually the paintbrush came along and then people were, painting pictures. And then Photoshop came along and then people were using Photoshop. So it's like right now, artists who are in Photoshop and in all of these digital pieces of software that we use are now complaining about AI.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the rise in technology and the advancement of technology is always going to be something that's inevitable, right? So it's technology has never phased us out, and I feel like if we keep romanticizing this whole ideology that it will phase us out, well then maybe that's what's gonna happen. But if we pay careful attention to that chronological stepping stone of history that technology has gone through, like, we'll see that we've always managed to stay on top of it and use it to our advantage. And I just think, like I said before, we've got to put our heads together and think, how can we ride that wave so we are in control and, you know, and we don't allow it to take us over.
Excellent. Absolutely. Go ahead, Sabina. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the main difference for how AI as a tool differentiates between those other ones, though, is that you've still got a human, like, kind of controlling it with AI and how it actually works. A lot of the time, you kind of give it an input, like a developer has designed it to act in a certain way, and then it spits out what you want the answer to be. But that in-between process of that creation process is so important. So if I give, for example, Midjourney, I'm like, make me an image of a unicorn from like the Egyptian era, and it'll like do it, and it'll be hieroglyphics or whatever. Mm. If I told my friend and I briefed someone, can you do the same image for me? I'm paying them for their value and their brain and all the inputs and all the outputs and how they're processing that. Whereas an AI, I don't know what inputs it's got. I don't know how, like, it's coming to the decision it's making. And how an AI operates, it's always trying to optimize. It's trying to do the most efficient route from getting to A to B. That's how it's designed. That's how essentially the technology works. But something like the pen and paper compared to like Photoshop, like, you're still able to like maneuver the ins and outs of it and change how it gets from start to finish. With an AI, it will give it to you. And there's no real way for us as layman's terms, in terms of like, I'm not a developer, I can't unpick that AI. But, and often developers themselves can't unpick the AI to understand how it works. They're called black box algorithms. You know, the kind of mechanics behind it, sometimes even they're like, we're not quite sure how it reached this conclusion, but it's doing it, like, well done us. So I think that's a big part around why AI is so different in this sense. And also the inputs of, like, you know, the kind of lack of respect for the artists when it comes to the data that's being fed into this, to these machines as well. Mm. It's such a big part of it. Whereas I, as an artist, if I make something, I can credit, like, oh yeah, that's inspired by like this concert I went to 3 months ago. And also probably a bunch of things that I can't really recognize, but I know that it's still kind of part of my journey. It's not just being fed and forced to me.
100%. Mm. But do you think that that's what causes the fear then? The fact that we don't completely understand how it works? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's part of the design. I think that's, if you go back to technology, if you look at how like Google and Facebook run, like, you know, when they were essentially creating what is Web 2.0 now, and all the ways that we interact with the internet, like, how many of you have read a privacy policy or terms of use online? Probably not. Oh, you have? Yeah. Great. Yeah. But like, yeah, I do as well. But I don't think majority of people do, because it's designed to be like obtuse. Yes. It's designed to be like getting in your way. Like, yeah, cool, I'll give you my information so I can get to what I want. Like, transparency, privacy has been like showed to us in digital platforms as an obstacle to get into what we want. If there were people who are building Web 2.0 from the 2000s onwards, if they were doing it and they weren't like in the mindset of, oh, we need to kind of hide away all the icky things we're doing because we want to push them through our product. If it was designed in a different way where privacy was kind of embedded into what we're doing and transparency was part of digital platforms and a part of the process, then I think we would be at a different stage now with AI, where our understanding of it is completely different because the people building it don't have this notion that, oh, we can get away with hiding things from them because they won't ever ask, they won't ever prod. Regulations so slow, so it's all fine. I do think that's part of the wider arc that we've seen with Web 2.0.
Yeah, fantastic point, honestly, especially from generations now coming up who are demanding that transparency from brands. Why are they not demanding that transparency from the technology that's actually driving these brands? That's a great point. So, Amy, repeat what you said earlier, my love. You look clearer as well, actually. Yeah.
I think we need to think about the way that people are interacting with the technology and that what is happening with it. But at the same time, I think the AI could be the solution to the AI problem as well. Effectively, it's a tool. It's an instrument. It can be used to hurt people. It can be used to improve people's lives. So I think a lot of the solutions that we might find around the debate of how it's being used and the transparency around it might actually also be solved by different types of AI technologies as well.
Yeah, but do you not think that's circular? Then it becomes circular? So it's like, okay, AI has caused a problem. We're going to use AI to try and fix it, but it's brought up another problem. So we're just going to keep going round. Do you not think?
It is, but there has been no invention that I can think of in the entirety of the human existence that once we've created it, it's been put back in a box.
True.
It's here, it's kind of here.
True.
I think a really interesting analogy we can maybe think about is the introduction of the printing press. So that was in the 15th century, so it happened obviously a very long time ago. But the debate around it was that it was going to be a massive disruption to the traditional model of people physically sitting down and writing books. It was seen as an amazing invention because it increased accessibility, it spread information more widely, and access really, really grew. It was the foundation of IP and copyright discussions. Without it, we wouldn't have those things, and those protections were put in place to help and protect artists. And, you know, things got cheaper, so there's an economic factor as well. But ultimately, there was an ethical consideration as well, where actually the distribution of knowledge more widely started to threaten things like organized religion. It started to change politics. And part of this is that, yes, it can be used to reinforce really existing negative structures that exist within the world and power structures. But equally, it could be the tool that helps break down those structures, because ordinary people can have that tool and that access and that capability in their hands, where actually some of those prohibitive things, like being able to access really good technology, was something that was controlled by very, very few creative studios. If we're in a world where anyone can be a creative studio, again, the only differentiator is going to be creative quality, and it's opening up those worlds. So actually, maybe you don't have to be part of those really giant creative studios as a writer anymore. Maybe you can actually go on and do smaller projects yourself as well.
Great point, because it's similar to what social media did, isn't it? It's very, very similar, you know? So it's like, no, I don't have to be a big brand agency to be able to put out content. All I need is my iPhone and an editor, and that's it. And then you have influencers who can get huge audiences and get their content in front of those audiences. So you're saying it's actually very similar, isn't it? That scenario. No, you're right. Jude, any comments on that?
No, man, I think Amy pretty much summed it up. I mean, I agree with the notion. It was just like I was saying before. I feel like potentially, AI itself probably holds some of the answers in terms of helping to solve these problems. Just like I say, I don't believe in too much of this, dwelling on too much of the fear mongering. And I agree with what Savina said. You know, it's definitely... when it comes to machine learning and how neural networks work and everything, everything's just kind of come to a place where there's a lot that we don't necessarily understand about how it works. But at the end of the day, AI is something that, to me, is kind of like it's like a child that is mimicking its parents, and like, I guess we're its parents. So, you know, like one thing I heard recently was, if we begin to, like, I don't want to say like behave a certain way, or if we kind of understand what to do to influence, I guess, the machine learning patterns of how the AI is rising, then we could be sort of taking a lot more control of maybe like certain AI tools. I know the cat's out of the bag now, and everyone's saying it's too late, it's too late, it's here to stay. Yeah. We can't control it. And, you know, Elon Musk is saying what he's saying about it. It's like, you know, the end is nigh, et cetera. I just feel like that's quite pessimistic, you know. And once again, just like I was saying before, if we just focus on positive ways of using AI so it can help solve some of the problems that we're talking about, then that's probably the best way to spend our time rather than worrying about it.
I think you're right as well. Yeah, no, good points. Really good points. So I'm going to move on now to basically kind of like going on from everything that everyone has said. I want to talk about glazing. And for the audience, if you don't know what glazing is a algorithm that has been put together by both traditional and digital artists. And what it does is it kind of scrambles the pixels so that the AI learning machine can't actually learn what it's like. So if you ask to put a glazed image and a non-glazed image side by side to the human eye, they look exactly the same. but the machine is not able to take all of the kind of like minute details like brush strokes or color palettes or whatnot from the image in order for it to be trained. So it kind of protects what makes the artwork unique to the artist. I've seen some storyboard artists from Riot Games who are part of this, and they are pushing it hard, and they feel that it's one of the ways to protect your work from, you know, just being fed to the machine. I want to ask about your thoughts on that, because there've been lots of companies who have removed the opt out for, you know, allowing your work to train the AI. So Sabina, I think I'm going to start with you on that. Let me know your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I find it wild that this is an industry that we have to protect ourselves from. Like, what other kind of dynamic is there? There's not like, oh, I have to protect myself from the healthcare system because they're going to use all my information without me knowing. Like, the way you have to protect yourselves against digital services, like giving fake numbers out, fake like email addresses. I'm not going to give them my real name when I'm signing up for this thing because I'm scared about this. And now we're getting to a point where artists are like, I can't release my information online, my actual art, because I'm scared it's going to be sucked up by an AI. I think fundamentally, as we've reached that stage with digital services, I think we're a bit broken with our relationship there. I think there's something that really needs to be fixed across the board. And then when it comes specifically to these cases, I think there's always been an issue around IP and copyright online, like how things are saved. Like, I remember in 2019, the EU were trying to introduce a bunch of laws. I think it was like the directive on copyright. And it got mocked completely online because there were certain kind of directives or kind of sub-articles in that law they were trying to put forward that might essentially like legalize the use of memes. And so essentially, like, how do you circulate like information online, which is still like recognizing the creator, but also isn't like infringing? Like, what is copyright in 2020? It doesn't really make sense. Like, those laws are really outdated, and IP laws are really outdated, and they're not keeping up with technology's pace, and that's because regulation is always so much slower. And so that as a whole across the internet is already a big issue of like how that functions. Bring AI into it, and again, you've got this lack of transparency issue. People aren't willing to share what their data sets are, so then how do you know where your work is being taken? I think it's like, if you look at facial ID, for example, that's been around for a lot longer than image generated kind of AI services for the public. So facial ID, if you look at breaking down where some of the sources are for how facial ID around the world for like military uses as well have been trained up, you've got Facebook is a huge one, Flickr, thousands and thousands of like pictures from Flickr. There are weird like university funded projects where like professors set up a camera and for like 7 days straight, and it just took photos of everyone who walked past like the entrance to their kind of room. That was funded by the military. It's undisclosed, we don't know which military, but military funding. So things like that are making up like military level facial recognition technology, you know. So there's always been an issue around what's ethical data collection for an AI, and you're seeing models of that now, like Mozilla do a lot of work around this, of like their voice, they're kind of doing like voice assistance from like voluntary, like giving away, like I sign away the rights to give my voice for this like project. There's like more local communities, so trying to preserve like languages that might only be spoken by 1,000 people. And there's also other ways of, you know, so there are consent models in place. And so whilst it's great that like we're having, you know, some technology being developed to kind of protect people online, I just question why we should even get to this place in the first place. Like, why are we getting here when we could be thinking and improving about, like, we could improve consent models, like, online? That's where I think the focus should be. I'm not saying their work shouldn't be existing. I think it's great. I think there's just different ways of thinking about it beyond using a technological fix.
Wow. So do you think that glazing is an overreaction then?
No, I think it's a normal reaction. I think like what we said here, like you want to use technology to kind of serve you in a way. And so I think when there's ever a problem, I think technology is always going to be seen as a solution. But I think it should be seen as like one solution, not the solution.
That's not my solution.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, it's a really tough one. So glazing is an incredible piece of technology. Yeah. It's incredibly smart. And I think it also points a little bit to who's in control of things. So when we have corporations looking to capitalize on the output of others' free labor, we get people's images being stolen and we get broken consent models. When we get education systems developing technology, you come up with something like glazing because the agendas that sit within those two things are quite different. I completely agree with Savina that we need to be looking at bigger systemic issues that sit outside of just AI. Consent models have been a huge issue across the entire internet. And the real challenge for us is that we're effectively jazzy monkeys that are wearing fancy clothes. Like, we haven't evolved to keep up with the pace of technology. We have to look at this as a global issue as well, because it effectively becomes a bit of a space race. So, for instance, in Japan, they've just passed legislation that effectively allows any algorithm or any AI to be trained on any data set. And they've basically said copyright doesn't exist if it's being used for training purposes on AI models. So when you have actual states legislating at that kind of level, we could fix everywhere else in the world and you'd always have that kind of element there. So I think that's why it's got to be a multifaceted solution. Again, Serena hit it on the head with legislation. There's always a massive lag versus technological capabilities. If anyone saw the questioning of TikTok in Congress, like, the level of understanding of even basic internet is terrifying amongst lawmakers. So then again, part of the problem is making sure that we have people in these rooms and in these spaces that are diverse, that understand the technology and its capabilities, and are kind of serving a greater purpose there for legislation. But that's a whole other kind of systemic issue that we need to try and tackle as well. But I think what AI is really good at is it's really good at holding a mirror up to the bigger flaws in society and showing them much, much quicker and much, much faster because of the speed it's able to iterate at.
Yeah, you're right. So going back to what you said about the Japanese legislation, because I wasn't aware of that. Do you think that's them exploiting a loophole? I mean, because you can get away with saying everything's for training purposes, you know, and just do whatever the hell you want.
Exactly. So it's very specifically around educational training of an AI model. So it's, but then you get into questions, well, what happens if you take that model into commercial purpose? Like, how does that affect it?
Exactly.
There are obviously kind of pushbacks to that. So you have really big companies like Adobe who are really pushing to only train algos on royalty-free images. Obviously, they have a vested interest in that on the basis that they have paid for premium kind of stock library content. So there's definitely kind of pushbacks and forces to these things, but it is a bit of a battle in terms of agenda and who kind of sits behind them.
I think so. Before I go on, Jude, what's your thoughts on glazing then?
Yeah, so I mean, I think like protection techniques like glazing are like a brilliant idea that obviously like give the power back to the artist. And it kind of reminds me of like a kind of like a technological version of when like a shopkeeper or a bank cashier is trying to verify if you've given them an authentic £50 note. You know, glazing acts as like a similar type of verifier. But I still think we have a long way to go in other areas. So I remember in 2011, the UK Intellectual Property Office were making this big hoo-ha about how people's brand logos can be kind of taken from one territory into another. And let's just say, for instance, you took something like, I don't know, like the, let's just say like a Nike logo. You take that to another territory and you make like a 3D version of it and you kind of like rotate it a bit. You can use like a 3D rotated version of someone's brand logo and then start selling and flogging products based on another version of their same logo. You know, and I don't think that these problems have actually been, these types of problems have been solved yet. You can still do stuff like that. And then there's, you know, just things like how people can do similar types of things on the dark web and all of that kind of stuff. There's a lot of, so I think everyone's kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of needing to improve legislation and around, I guess, like consent models. But again, you know, going back to what Savina said, do you think that AI could be used to solve these problems, or do you think that that's, you know, do you think that that's a conversation that needs to be had between humans?
I think I'm always erring on the side of hesitancy towards jumping into using AI, because sometimes I take a seat back and I think about how much money has been invested in some AI. And I think, okay, so for example, hypothetically, you've created an AI that can solve educational inequality. What if you used all that money to just like fairly pay teachers? Where would you get? And so like when we're thinking about can we use AI to like solve the issues, I kind of do come back to like the funding question as well. Like, why is that money being spent there and not there?
Yeah.
I think, yeah. Good point. Yeah, go ahead, Jude.
I've got nothing to add. I think that's a good point. We do need to watch how we're spending money, because I guess that's something that could lead to the phasing out of human beings. If we're spending all our money and time on resources, then we might be spending money on our demise.
Oh dear! Sorry, you just reminded me of iRobot, where the machine was like, "Yeah, I have to save humans from themselves because humans are actually the problem," you know. So, but no, let's not go down that particular rabbit hole. But in terms of the glazing, I've understood everything that everyone has said, but I think take it back down to again the artist. Mm. So the artist is going to, you know, create a really cool piece of work, you know, and they're. While they understand that there is a bigger systemic issue with IP and protecting their work, they're at that very point in time, they're not really going to care. They just don't want to see their work being used by someone else, especially who doesn't have the same skill set as them, use it to gain either recognition for themselves or even worse, money. And so I just wanted to understand, what do you think about that? If you were to put yourself in the place of the artist, what would you do if it was your own work?
What do you mean? What would we do if it was our own work being stolen?
Yeah. If that was that's why I think glazing has taken off the way that it's taken off. Yes, it's not a solution, you know, end of solution, but a lot of artists feel that this is the one thing that they can do to protect themselves. I mean, do you remember a couple of months ago when Drake kicked off, when someone did his songs? He went crazy. He went absolutely crazy, you know? Yeah. And that is when and because they have power and access to legal, then they can do something about that sort of thing. The layman artist who is just trying to make a day-to-day living can't do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm just asking, what do you think?
Yeah, why can't they protect themselves? Even if I'm, you know, questioning the need for an AI tool, I think the same way, like, I would support the strikers. I would support, like, anyone who's basically just trying to make, like, fairer working conditions for themselves. And if this is part of their journey to doing it, because it's the only tool they have access to, you know, they might not be able to join a union in the area that they live in. They might not be able to, you know, exactly. They might not have sufficient means to be able to take them to court, because we all know, again, financially, that's like really tricky. And even being able to prove this AI case in court is going to be a minefield for people who are trying to do it. So if this feels like, oh, this is a quick win to protect me and my practice, like, I've got nothing against people who just want to basically like live a fair life and be paid for their work.
Exactly. Amy, what do you think?
Yeah, I think anything that can be done on an individual's level to give people autonomy is really, really important. And I think by the same token, there's probably going to be people who are actually really up for their artwork being used to train different models, because it's not necessarily a direct threat to them. The way that it gets used, it's obviously fed in with lots and lots of other different material, but that has to be on like an individual artist right to choose. Equally, like, you know, if you could get paid a licensing fee, for example, to add yours to a collection of training models, that would be great. Like, people would be probably quite up for that. And then you get into debates on kind of fair recompensation, which is something like Spotify, where people talk about actually the remuneration you get for the ability to stream as an artist is very poor compared to what you might get kind of otherwise. But I think it's quite interesting as well to think about this through time, because yes, if you're an artist creating right now, today, and it is your career and it is your living, that's something really important. Do we bring the same protections to things that maybe have passed copyright? So what if you're an artist that's over 100 years old? Does that kind of change the debate? So is that then something that becomes more copyright free? Do we feel more comfortable doing that kind of thing? So it's a bit of a debate, I think, in terms of how we use this, but I think having access models where you can either be paid for your right to be trained with is great. But equally, if you want to block, that's also really important. But again, I come back to the fact that this is not the only arena in which artists are being ripped off. We can look to things like Shein is a great example, consistently rips off the work of makers and artists and craftspeople and designers, just straight copies and puts them into production. So that is the same problem. AI doesn't touch that process, but it's the same kind of structures that sit behind it that are causing a lot of these behaviours.
I think so. And I think just to your point, that if that means that AI is compounding on problems that already exist, basically. Yeah, I think so. Jude, go ahead, man.
So, I mean, I think your question was, what would we do if our work was stolen?
Yeah, as in, just a little bit of empathy is essentially what I'm saying. So if it's like, if it's your work, what would you do? That's why I thought glazing is necessary. I think it's necessary because I don't want to do a lovely piece of anime work and then all of a sudden I have someone who's, they projected it on the screen at their concert. It's like, well, give me my money, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, obviously if you're someone like Drake and you got access to, you know, like high level lawyers, etc., then you just pay your lawyers to sort it out. If you're someone, and then hope for the best, I guess. If you're someone less privileged, such as myself, well then we're probably going to have to, you know, go forward using like techniques of things like glazing or potentially like lobbying for more things like what Amy said in terms of making sure that maybe going forward you have to, you know, get paid a licensing fee or get paid some kind of compensation for your work being ripped off or any work that's come from you, you know, that's being used in your own image or likeness. But and if there's one thing, again, if there's another thing we've learned from history is once humans outside of technology get together and band together and scream loudly enough about something, then, you know, the system's going to have to pay attention to that. So I think hopefully that's an area that AI won't be able to overrule us with if, you know, we can scream loudly enough about something. But I mean, you know, if it's already been stolen, then unfortunately it's already been stolen. And funnily enough, when you mentioned that thing about Drake, I didn't actually know that he cared about that. I think there was was it like a Drake and a Kendrick Lamar song that was like,
something like that. What's her name?
Well, what did he?
Snow. What is her name? What is her name? Snow.
What did
he
do about it? Do you know what?
He just went to his lawyers. Yeah, he went to his lawyers, and he put. The lawyers started to look into it, didn't they? They'll look into it, and then they can use their power of attorney and whatnot and get this shut down, citing that it's copyright infringement. But to your point, not everyone has that sort of money or that sort of access to people who can help them like that. Yeah. You know, it was all fine when they were doing it to, I forget her name, honestly. It's not Taylor Swift, it was someone else. I forget her name. That was fine. You know, and I'm sure he was seeing loads of things on Instagram where he was like, oh, this is really cool. Oh, they've mimicked Justin Bieber's voice. Oh, this is cool. As soon as it was done with his work, that's when the dude kicked off, you know? So do you see what I mean? It's just like, that's a double standard, isn't it? You can do it to everyone else, but just don't do it to me.
Well, it's a shame. Yeah. But yeah, I think, I think if everyone has a loud enough conversation about it, then hopefully, I guess that kind of activity can get regulated in some way.
But do you think it will be kind of like a group effort, as in the kind of like day-to-day artists getting big enough to say something? Or do you think it's going to be people like Drake or Taylor Swift or Beyonce? Imagine what would happen if Beyonce kicked off about this.
Hopefully it'll be a combination, you know, like, because look at what the... You know, look at what we have now with the writer's strike. It's a big group of people that are creating loud enough, you know, conversation about it. And now we're here talking about it. So imagine if people as influential as Drake were also, you know, frontlining that conversation as well. You know, you can't ignore that. So hopefully something would change as a result of that. And I think we shouldn't forget that. That's the kind of activity and approach that humans outside of technology can still take in terms of like our own agency to change things.
Yeah.
Definitely.
No, good point.
And there's another example of there's a class action going on at the moment against ChatGPT, and I think that's being combined. I think Sarah Silverman is one of the writers involved in that.
Yes, she is.
A little bit easier to prove maybe than visual styling lawsuits, because you can directly compare kind of transcripts of copy and things like that. Running a class action with big figureheads, that's probably one of the ways that this starts to gain a bit more traction with legislation. Given money tends to talk, I think the more that this kind of hurts, it does tend to work. But I think, I mean, Savannah, you'll know more about this than we do, but it's a lever that you can pull to, I think, start addressing these situations. It's not going to be the one thing. I think it's going to have to be a combined effort. But we do then really get into these really interesting conversations around hypocrisy. So to your point, it's fine when other people do it, but not when it's kind of maybe Drake's music. As an artist, if I'm saying that I don't want my work to be used in any form of AI language training model, does that mean I have to swear off all forms of AI and algorithmic technology myself? So can I not use technology in case it's not been trained on those things? So it's, again, there's a bit of a dynamic here where it says, are you even able to extract yourself from that system so fully, because it touches so many different parts of kind of behind the scenes technology that a lot of people don't see in their everyday life.
Fantastic point. Because, you know, Whoopi Goldberg has come out with that. She said that, she's put it in her will. She's like, I don't want my voice or likeness to be used to train AI models. And we're like, cool.
Thanks,
Whoopi. Yeah, exactly. Sabina, what were you going to say? Sorry.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. And I think a lot of people have had to like draw those kind of like moral, like digital ethical lines as well. Like I am fully against the Facebook business model. I think it's like infringes on so many of our human rights. But I need Instagram to run a creative studio, because it's how we communicate what we do. And it makes me feel icky, but you have to kind of, I think people are going to come to these stages where you have to draw your own ethical boundaries of what am I comfortable with. I can talk at a tech conference, but if it's like, if it's sponsored by AWS, how do I feel about that? You know, even though, it's, you know, you have to kind of, it's just another arena where you're going to have to decide, like, you know, how much capitalism is going to kind of infringe on your workplace. Like, there's no ethical like consumption, but there can be considered consumption.
Yeah, that's such a great way to put it. And it leads nicely on to my next question, everyone. So let's talk about artist exploitation. We've kind of touched on it and IP. So one of the biggest ones that happened, I think it was a year ago now, was with DeviantArt. And this is for the audience. And basically, DeviantArt is a massive platform where people put all of their drawings and their digital paintings on there. Usually fan art, but people have been able to build their own followings via DeviantArt. DeviantArt actually literally emailed their entire audience and said, hi, we're going to be training our AI models with your work, and there's not much you could do about it. There was no opt-out. You can imagine the fallout. People went crazy. There was a massive exodus off the platform. A lot of other companies, even ones that are not even related to visual arts or digital painting, like even Twitter, I'm not calling it X, it's Twitter, have said that, we're going to use your images to train our AIs. You can opt out, but finding the opt out is like finding a needle in the quantum realm, you know? So again, what's your thoughts on companies who do this?
Make the opt out option less of a needle in the haystack, and like, you know, it should probably be that, like, you know, like making artists sort of like, and just even consumers in general, read these like extremely long forms that, you know, they're not going to read, just so they can sign the terms and conditions. Or like you say, like having an opt-out option that's like a needle in the haystack, I just think that should be illegal. You know, it's like these are huge platforms that really like affect people's lives in a big way. And once again, you know, if there's a loud enough conversation that we can create somehow and band together to make it, I don't know, somehow illegal or against the law for it to be so difficult for you to be able to access options, don't violate your human rights. I think that's the kind of direction we need to start going in. Even going back to what Savina was saying about, like, you know, Facebook you know, like, you know, you sign up to this platform, you know, you've got like 1,000 pages of their policy, privacy policy, terms and conditions. The people who run the platform know that you're not going to read all of that. They know you're not a lawyer, and they know you're just going to try and get to the end of it and just quickly click, boom, you know, I agree. And why aren't we having a conversation around why that isn't illegal? Like, why is that legal? Mm. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've reached the point where, okay, we get it now. You spent lots of time during the digital period of time that we're in getting away with that. I don't think big tech firms should be able to get away with that stuff anymore. It should be illegal.
Well, funnily enough, in one of my first exhibitions I ever did, we printed out Facebook policy and put it on like this huge scroll of like point like 8 or something like that. And it was, really? It just took up like from floor to wall, like it was huge. And so, yeah, like just being able to confront and look at that is daunting as well. But going back to the point about legality, like GDPR, which is like the big EU law, which is meant to protect us online, like there's explicit clauses in it, is that like giving away your personal information or your personally identifiable information should only ever be opt-in. It can't be like you have to opt in for it. You can't automatically be opted in for it. Like GDPR, yeah. Everyone kind of remembers it because it's cookies and you're getting all these emails from random people all the time. That was because people were freaked out that people weren't correctly opted in for the marketing lists or whatever it is kind of way they were storing your data. But now, like, the problem, like, that's a really great piece of legislation, I think. And, like, if that can be broadened out across kind of different platforms, like we said, if it is just opt-in, it's just we don't have, seem to be, like, the regulators who are, like, enforcing it. There's not enough manpower and, like, common knowledge to be, like, well, if I personally see something that makes me opt in and I have to opt out, that is a violation of GDPR and I can report them to the ICO. But that's not necessarily like common knowledge because we're not really told about our digital rights. But again, by making it opt in, I guess because there's a, you know, argument to be made if art is like personal identifiable information, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the kind of the framework is there and it's just not, like, it just need to kind of tie up these bits and get them together because it's insane that is opt out, like, and it's so difficult to opt out. Like, that shouldn't, yes. I don't know, I just don't understand how that as a business case was decided as well. Well, I guess the shareholders, think of the shareholders.
You please think of the shareholders. Exactly. Amy, go for it.
I think there's probably a generational component to this as well that's quite interesting to look at. So I know like I kind of grew up online and definitely remember that switch and the pivot between offline world into online world. And the typical kind of millennial experience is just posting everything everywhere. I definitely see younger members of staff, young people I live around, are way more hesitant about what they're sharing online. They're much more careful with their personally identifiable information. And even down to like their artistic expression is really, really different. So gone are the kind of cheesy millennial selfies. It's a lot of kind of blurred imagery or kind of snapshots of like maybe a limb or something like that. It's I find it really interesting that they're almost kind of self-censoring a lot of this information as it goes up. So they're choosing to participate in these systems, but it's in a very, very different way and different experience. I think ultimately we'll see that leading to different types of platforms and different types of owned materials. I think Will.i.am, randomly from the Black Eyed Peas, is working on a new platform that centers you as a kind of digital ID. And obviously there's a couple of other technologies, particularly around gaming now, that means maybe you will have a profile that transfers from platform to platform.
That's right.
So I think potentially things like that, things like blockchain might start introducing different ways that we think about personally identifiable information, where it's kind of contained in more of a singular unit. But again, there's got to be some legislation points here. There's got to be things to catch up, but you need people who understand the systems to kind of be at the forefront of that. And again, it kind of comes back to that point of we have people making legislation that fundamentally just don't understand even what the internet is, let alone being capable of having these more kind of sophisticated ethical discussions around very specific pieces of data sharing. So that's a big plus. Maybe we all need kind of digital education in school about our rights and things. I think that could be a really great place to start.
I think that's a great idea. I've actually written that down about digital rights, so maybe it's something we could talk about on a different podcast. Because it was interesting with DeviantArt, because a lot of the artists, even though they were new to AI, knew that this was not for them. So they just left, you know. What I think has happened, however, is that companies are becoming a lot more sophisticated about how they communicate this. So, for example, I don't know whether you've heard that Microsoft have now said that they have a pool of money that if something that's been generated with AI and then a third party makes an IP claim, they will pay for that. And I'm like, Sabina, what do you think of that, actually, before I throw my hat in? What do you think?
This kind of reminds me of like arguments around paying people to give their data away, because on the kind of surface of it, you're like, you can kind of see how that makes sense, like from a business. Yeah, we are the product. We're giving away our data. We should be paid for it. But then when you unpack it a bit, it's like, well, like, I'm giving up my right to privacy here. I'm giving up fundamental digital rights that I have and should have remain online. I'm giving up a sense of security. Like I'm allowing myself to be surveyed. Why am I putting a price on it? And then you're entering territories of, well, people who have kind of maybe a greater financial need for this payment are then giving up their privacy, and those who can afford can keep it. And so I feel like financial incentives around these sort of things will always just play into the dynamic and like current systems we already have. Like who's that really helping? Who's this pot of money really helping? That's why I'm like, throwing money at the problem. Where is that going to get you? It's going to get you to reinforce the current systems that we have and help those who are already up there.
Yeah, I can see. That's a really interesting point, because I could see the kind of divide in society that would manifest. So, you know, you've got kind of like all the, I don't know, like the sort of working class or sort of poorer people who would basically just be selling themselves and their whole families down the river. And then, you know, you'd have all the well-off people who don't need to sell themselves. So therefore they'd get to like protect their privacy. And it's just, another period of time that would show the class divide, you know, the ever widening class divide. So yeah, that system doesn't really help.
No, I took it with a bucket of salt, honestly. I know Adobe have said exactly the same thing as well, even though, to your point, Amy, they have at least tried to train their AI on royalty-free images. But even that is like, to me, you're just exploiting another loophole. What do you think? Amy?
I didn't know that was directed back at me. So it is, but yeah, again, it's a wider trend we see, right? So it's not just in AI. So you go into any supermarket in the UK now, and all of them have introduced a loyalty scheme, which means you must have the loyalty scheme. You must track your shopping habits and spends to be able to access promotional deals. So again, financial incentivizing, that reinforcement. Yeah. It's gone up a notch in the last sort of 2 years, I think, because before it was kind of a nice to have, whereas now it's like, if you physically want to access better prices, you must have these things. You walk down the street, you're surveyed by CCTV constantly, your data is going into that, you're being captured. And again, that's being used to train models. And these are kind of real world things as well. They don't just exist in the digital landscape and environment. And again, it's this bigger conversation around privacy. What does privacy mean in this century? What will it mean in 50 years time? And when things aren't being deleted, like there's the right to be erased on the internet, for example. So it's just this idea of lingering and capturing. It's something that exists outside of these individual platforms. Definitely not saying that they are kind of faultless and blameless in the training of these models. But again, it's something that exists much, much more widely and broadly in society. And we've got to be framing this within these bigger discussions versus just looking at like one isolated piece of the puzzle.
I think so. Again, though, it goes back down to the whole, okay, I'm an artist. What do I do about this? Yeah, because, you know, people have built massive, massive communities on platforms like DeviantArt or Patreon or, you know, ArtStation or what have you. And it's like, if you take that away from them, or if they decide to kind of remove themselves for it, how else are they going to then get out their work? Are they going to go back to putting it out on the street or you know, galleries and whatnot? Do you see how it just goes back to your point, Savina, where technology has created a problem, and we might have to use technology in order to solve that same problem. You know, cool. Okay, everyone, I'm going to go now into the big one, and one that I feel quite strongly about because it does actually affect someone like me from my particular community. So bias in the machine is becoming a huge talking point now, where images that are being spat out, even blocks of text and everything else that's being spat out by ChatGPT and some of the other ones like Bard and Duet and whatnot, are showing more and more race and gender stereotypes. Have there been any examples of where you have worked with AI and you've come across any of these kind of biases or stereotypes? I'll leave that open.
Maybe I can jump in here. But so I did an exhibition in 2021 for Identity 2.0, and it was called This Machine is Black, and it explored the relationship between race and technology. And one of the largest pieces that we created for it was like a really big timeline, which we've now published online, and looked at the hyper-visibility and the hyper-invisibility of blackness throughout time. And essentially, like, there are times when, like, that kind of, like, being black is, like, at the forefront of your identity, and that's kind of how you're being labelled as, and other times when essentially, like, data sets completely miss you out as well and things are completely unrecorded. And by doing this research and a lot of the work that we were doing in the exhibition, we were able just to be able to see, like, how algorithmic bias is essentially just replicating kind of like systems of oppression throughout time. Yeah. So you've got something like, what have we got? Like, so for example, the example of if I put in to like a image generator, oh, show me like an Asian woman, like an East Asian woman, it's going to be like extremely hypersexualized and things like that. So where are those ideas fed from, and how they're fed into algorithms are like part of how society is built. They're like a reflection, as Amy said, like a mirror of like kind of what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so the example of way that like black people are presented in AI generated images, that was like picked up in a great book called Algorithms of Oppression, where if black girls were put into Google image search, it was like very hypersexualized image that would come up. And this goes back to essentially how like photographs of like black women, how would you get them in the first place, and like under what circumstances were they created, and how black bodies have been viewed throughout time. And that's just one example. It was like a huge research piece we did, which was really exciting, but kind of unearthed so many different ways that essentially AI is just absorbing all the crap that, sorry, I'm gonna say that, sorry. No. Yeah. Basically, AI is trained on data made by a society that is sexist, that is racist, that is homophobic, mm-hmm. that is like heteronormative. Like, there's so many ways that like our identity is like split up in society, so the data sets themselves are inherently going to have these biases in them. There was like Amazon were trying to use a hiring AI.
The hiring algorithm. Oh,
it's like a classic, isn't it?
So bad.
And it's like Facebook.
Yeah, and maybe for listeners who haven't heard of it, it was an AI that they used to basically scan CVs and say, yeah, we want to replicate our exec board because they're great, and this is the type of people we want to hire. And then when they got through a number of rounds, they were like, oh, it's all men. I wonder why that is. And it was because the AI had learnt that, oh, the exec board are all white males, so then that's what we should be looking for in the CVs. So things like women's debate club, nah, get it out. Like, the AI there is a tool which has been trained on a data set which is inherently flawed. The same way if you train it on like police data, so you know, if you're kind of like, who's been arrested, figure out who's gonna be arrested next, where it's like, well, the institution itself has got issues, so why are you then trying to replicate it and accelerate it using AI? All it can do is, like we said, it can show you correlations, it can't show you causations. So it's never going to be able to unpick
exactly.
It.
Exactly. Love that.
Yeah, and this is why it's a technology that it's so important who's creating it, as well as how it's being used as well, because again, it's typically white men, normally Americans, that are building this type of technology. So it's a really limiting pool of society. So another example is how algorithms are making judgment calls. So we can take something like the Instagram algorithm. So there was a case I think a couple of years ago of Naomi Nicholas Williams, who was a black plus size model, artist and creator. And her body was censored repeatedly in very artistic, beautiful, stunning photography because It's the policing of bodies that are other or seen as other by the system. Whereas you might go to a Playboy page and you've got full frontal nudity of very white, skinny women, and that doesn't get picked up in the same way. So again, partly it's this inherent bias and that's coming out in the system. It's about who's creating them. But it's also about people without the lived experience not being involved in the process of creation and ownership of algorithms that really can affect it as well. On the slightly more positive side, because I don't want to be all kind of doom and gloom around this, is, again, I'm a really passionate believer that if you want to use technology and algorithms for a more altruistic purpose, that is definitely something that is more possible now than ever. I have an advertising background. I spend a lot of time playing with stock imagery. You go to any stock image library, which has been manually created by human photographers, and trying to find interesting imagery that isn't formed in stereotypes is almost impossible a lot of the time. It's purposefully stereotypical most of the time that it's being created. So actually something like a generative AI, where you can be very specific around your prompting and kind of retraining it and reshaping the imagery that you're using, actually it can give you ways to kind of showcase and evolve representations of people in a way that actually maybe standard forms of production don't. So there's kind of two sides to the coin, and it's very much about how you're wielding it and who is wielding it, I think, is really important. But again, it can be used in a way to be much more positive and kind of break stereotypes as well.
Good point. I try to I don't know whether I can put it as try to break ChatGPT or try to teach ChatGPT, because I asked it a couple of weeks ago to personify the color magenta for me. So it gave me a long, it gave me a paragraph, and the paragraph was clearly Eurocentric. The way described, the way the algorithm described it as very long flowing hair, etc., etc. And I said to ChatGPT, first of all, why is she female? And secondly, why does she have kind of like Eurocentric features? I actually should actually send you the screen grab. The machine actually apologized. It's like, I'm really sorry, but yes, you're right. I'm going to try again. So do you think there's a bit of an onus on us then, Amy, for us to kind of, in small ways, maybe small, you know, small ripples, that we can kind of train these algorithms from our standpoint?
I do. And I think it's about first doing the work to really understand where your biases sit. You know, I have them too. There's things that, you know, I need to really question the way that I'm prompting, the way that I want to show things. Again, when you're using creativity for commercial purposes, you know, how many of us have sat in a room with creatives and had really stereotypical scripts back of, you know, the 2.0 family? You know, we're only just getting kind of black representations on television for Christmas ads. Like, and that, you know, it's 2022 that this is happening. So again, it's all parts of the industry, but I think the more we can do to try and challenge these stereotypes generally, it will help impact it in terms of the algorithms as well. And
cool.
I mean, I've worked with plenty of creative directors in my time where if I'd have challenged them and said, why are they like these things, I probably just would have got a mouthful of abuse. So at least the machine is being kind of eloquent and reframing itself and training. So I think this ability to learn can also, you know, we can use that ourselves and say, actually, how can I learn more? How can I make this more interesting, more balanced, more representative as well?
Fabulous. Jude, what were you going to say? Sorry.
So last year I developed a 2D animated concept for a television show called Family Britannia, about a young, like, British-born Nigerian tech genius, right? So then I got approached by the Children's Media Conference to, and we made a documentary for the Children's Media Conference up in Sheffield called Where Are All the Smart Black Males in TV? Because what I was trying to do is help transform the image of black males through this, like, TV show. So my exec producers for the project were Louise Bucknell, the head of kids programming at Nickelodeon, and Carl Jenkins, head of acquisitions at Milkshake and Channel 5. The conversation addressed basically, like, why we don't see more nuanced depictions of black males in children's content. Louise and a lady called Kelly Wood, they came back to me with, like, research and stats around the issue, and showed, like, all of this research showed that, like, black males, by the way, may I add, in children's content, right? So black males in children's content are apparently 75 times more likely to be portrayed as aggressive, violent, stupid, or not to be taken seriously. So I was super shocked by that problem, because, you know, like it was basically 10 times worse than I thought it, like it was when I literally proposed the idea for, you know, the documentary. And, you know, you can go and watch it on our YouTube channel. It's really good. We interviewed Pat Young, who was a BBC ex-commissioner, Laura Henry Lane, who wrote the books that inspired the JoJo and Grand Grand TV show. Marv Harrison and Casey Alicia and my mate Maxwell O'Guinney, who was like the first established Black UK animator I could find when I came out of uni. Easy. So, yeah, man, in terms of like media representation in regards to AI, like, you know, all of these like systems are trained based on biased data sets that can perpetuate negative stereotypes of Black males and media content. Obviously, I'm specifically super passionate about how, you know, Black males are portrayed. And, you know, especially like in movies and adverts and games. And obviously, like, this can often lead to overrepresentation of Black male roles associated with crime, violence, and, you know, reinforcing harmful negative stereotypes. So I think someone mentioned like image recognition as well, like facial recognition algorithms have been, you know, found to be like less accurate for Black individuals, leading to misidentification, wrongful convictions. And if you know, don't even get me started on the prison system in America, like that's just pretty much set up to use Black males as a pipeline for like their free labor. And if you want to find out more about that, you can watch a documentary on Netflix called Coded Bias, where this young lady called Joy from MIT lab, she found all of this I guess coded bias or algorithmic bias within facial recognition technology on phones. And she literally had to go to Congress to change a whole law around that, you know, that use of technology. So, yeah, man, you know, I think like just in general, like how this negative side of technology can influence communities as well is just on a slightly different note is I think it in some of it can encourage content creators, like both Black and non-Black content creators, to create content based on these types of stereotypes or a system that shows them that it will reward them for cinematically displaying the destruction of our community, specifically by young Black males, based on what I'm talking about. So, you know, like the amount of times I've seen documentaries where Black boys are like the face of knife crime in the UK, like I just think it's absolutely disgusting. And, you know, I forgot who it was that said it, but like in this country, the UK, right, you're more likely to get stabbed by a non-Black person leaving a pub than you are to get stabbed by like a couple of Black youths on an inner city council estate fighting over some insignificant drug territory or postcode war. And, you know, as a content viewer, if I was someone who didn't live in an area where there were any Black males or had never really met any Black people before, I may think that this was all they did if I was going by what I saw on TV or what I saw in the media. So like I say, at my studio, Anibox, this is one of the main issues that we're addressing through the content we create is, you know, the transformation of the image of the Black male in particular. And, you know, someone's got to do it. Someone's got to do something about it. And, you know, we're putting our money on this. And, you know, this is what we're going to be focusing on when we launch our first IP project.
Fantastic. And I think that's key, everyone, isn't it? The fact that while the onus is not so much on us, but we can take that and actually put content out there, especially if it's going to be used to train some of these AI algorithms to kind of combat these stereotypes. To your point, Amy, about the stock photography, because I had UK Black Tech approach me and they were just like, no, can we do a whole photo shoot where we have Black professionals, basically? Because if you type in Black professionals into iStock or Getty or whatnot about 5 years ago, you got nothing. You got absolutely nothing. So we actually had to go and create it ourselves. But I think we've got to the point now with technology that you could, doesn't even have to be a big photo shoot. You could just do that on the fly and everything else. So I think that's one of the ways that we can tackle it, because this is a very big issue. Yeah. Any closing comments, everyone? Because we've got like very little time left before we have to do an outro. And
Well, I think anything I'll say is just it's about looking at bigger systemic issues generally. And I think using, if we turn to AI algorithms and automation, we have to take really great care to make sure that we're not just replicating existing power structures that don't work and function for people. We have to use those technologies to build better versions of those things that actually do better, involve all members of society, have a better representation more generally. So we have to think about kind of power and control and how we're using that to deconstruct and rebuild versus just amplify things that aren't working. And we do that through, if there is anyone that is capable of doing that, it is artists, it is creators. They are the people who've always been at the forefront of that societal change. So yes, they're going to be the most attacked, but it's also where the power truly sits and lies. And Judo, like Savina, you're at the forefront of doing that work. And it's incredibly important that then people like me can decenter ourselves and kind of give you guys the platform. So I'm definitely be checking out that documentary. It sounds incredible. And your art exhibition, again, sounds stunning. So yeah, going to dig into that and learn a bit more.
Fantastic. Anyone else?
Yeah, I guess just going off that, you know, like, we're being in the creative industry means you have like the power to imagine a different future. Like, I think that's what we're all doing with our work, is that we're building different ways that our future can manifest itself and the different ways we want our communities to see themselves as well. And so I think like making sure that we remember the power that we have to create, and not necessarily being, I would just say, yeah, don't believe the hype that AI can like take that away from you. I don't think any tool can ever take away that need and that like impetus to want to create a different future. Like, your creativity and your imagination are such powerful tools. I'd say they're probably way more powerful than any AI can ever try to do. And sorry, that was a bad sentence, but your creativity, creativity and your imagination are way more powerful than any AI tool, really.
I think it's a fantastic point and a means to kind of really change the landscape, especially when it affects various communities. Awesome. So, well, on that note, gonna have to bring the discussion to an end. Thank you once again to my guests and Simon for hosting. Hi, Simon. And after listening to this episode, go and take a look at the previous seasons and episodes, as we have a wealth of information on everything Access VFX. So thank you again. Thank you, everyone.
Cool. Thanks, guys.
Well, that was another incredible conversation. Before you go, a couple of things as usual. Please go to Apple Podcasts, give us a 5-star rating, subscribe, and if you fancy it, leave us a nice review. And most importantly, please, please, please get involved with our Foundry-sponsored global e-mentoring program. If you are in the UK, Europe, USA, Canada, Australia, or New Zealand, you can sign up for free to be partnered with an industry mentor or become a mentor yourself to folks aspiring or just getting started in the visual effects, animation or games industry. Please note that in Europe you need to be aged 18 and over, the rest of the world 13 and over. Go to accessvfx.org/mentors and literally change someone's life. Thank you, Nene, for being a bloody amazing guest host. Thanks to Savannah, Jide and Amy for a wonderfully rich conversation. And of course, thanks to Steve Greaves on editing duties and Tom Box for the graphics. And last but not least, thanks to you for listening. We'll be back soon with another killer no filler episode. It just leaves me to say, from all of us at Access VFX, have a wonderful day and we'll see you on the next one.
There we go. End of another Access VFX podcast. We really hope you enjoyed it. To find out more about what we discussed, our mentoring program and events we're at, then head over to our website at www.accessvfx.org and follow us on social media. Big thank you for listening, and until next time,
bye.